This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome. This is Detailing Addiction. I'm Dr. Susan Blank on America's Web Radio. Today in studio, I have a dear friend and colleague, Vanessa Hebert. She's an LCSW, and we're going to ask her to explain what that means in just a moment. But it means licensed clinical social worker, but I'd like her to talk a little bit about that. She received her master's degree from Louisiana State University. And do you say Baton Rouge or... How do you say that word?
I say Baton Rouge.
Okay, good. After receiving her education, she worked in a variety of clinical settings, focusing on multiple aspects of adult mental health. Currently, she has her own private practice, and she has a very interesting, unique, and fresh approach to addressing the disease of addiction, how it affects the individual, the family, and the community. Today, we're going to talk about a day in the life of Vanessa Hebert and learn a little bit about her practice and a little bit about how she approaches her patients and some of the very unique and very powerful tools she has to help patients get better. So welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm really glad that you're here. Vanessa and I, in another life, worked together, and I learned a lot about her skill set and have been very happy to be able to share some patients/clients mm-hmm. over the years. What's always interesting to my listeners is, how did you get into this field? What made you choose addiction after you explained licensed clinical social worker?
Licensed clinical social worker. Thank you. Licensed clinical social worker is a master's level therapist, and the clinical component is after training. We get received the after a graduate school, a master's of social work is then we have 2 years of training where we become a licensed clinical social worker. I was always interested in working with people. I believe I have a personality of enjoying to be with people. So I was drawn to the helping professions. And when I learned about the difference between psychology and social work and the different counseling fields, I was drawn to social work because of the person in the environment perspective that it offers and looking at the whole person and starting where the person is versus applying a therapy or technique to their situation. You know, looking at the whole environmental effects on that person is very important in my profession and in my practice. I guess the way I became specifically drawn to addiction is, like many people, I imagine, is I have a personal experience from mm-hmm. in my family. I from a young adult, I was from a family that experienced addiction and alcoholism, and at a young age was aware that this was the problem that I was witnessing in my family. And I learned about alcoholism and drug addiction as a disease, the disease concept, way back when, as a young child. And back then, we didn't even have the same information we have today. But it made sense to me, what I learned and what I witnessed. So I was drawn to that. And I have having that personal connection, I have a passion for working mm-hmm. with people who struggle with addiction, because it's not oftentimes it's unnecessary that people have to struggle to the extent that they do. You know, there's help out there, and because of stigma and different cultural attitudes, not everyone always knows that they don't have to go to the depths of despair that we often see.
So the advantage, if you can frame it like that, in really understanding at an early age that what you were witnessing within your family was a disease. This wasn't just people being weak-willed or selfish or not trying to live their life to the fullest. Mm-hmm. There was something wrong, and it was a medical illness that was creating some of the behaviors and some of the problems.
Yes, most definitely. Yeah, most definitely. And the first treatment experiences that I was around, we were lucky enough to receive the education about that, even though they didn't have all the medical and scientific data that we do today. The idea was just coming out. This was like in 79, 80. Uh-huh. The idea was just coming out that there was an actual biological component. And so that education, along with what I witnessed in the people that I love personally, helped me to know that it was truly about that medical issue and not the person.
I think that is such an important thing. And one of the reasons that I'm a real advocate for family being involved. Because so many times the individual themselves gets this education and they begin to understand what's happened to them, how it's happened. But the family member is in the dark, and particularly children. I think it's really difficult for them not to understand that this is an illness. And if they aren't able to participate in a family education program and aren't able to get that kind of information, it leaves them confused. It leaves them resentful. It leaves them angry. It leaves them frightened. And they suffer enough without having this additional layer of difficulty because they really don't understand what's going on.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And it is, I think that's one of the biggest challenges I see in my practice is the need for the whole family to receive treatment and how, you know, if it's just one person that are using chemicals, why does the family need help? And what is hard for people to understand, it seems, is that the family in their own fear and reactions to the person struggling with addiction, they develop their own negative behaviors to cope, and it affects all the members of the family. And so that's a big component of what I work with in my practice with family members.
Mm-hmm. So their reactivity, and as we talk about the disease of addiction as a family disease, not just because of the genetics, but because other family members develop those coping skills to try and deal with the situation, but if they don't get treatment, then they perpetuate. They're likely, unconsciously, this isn't a purposeful thing, they're trying to survive, but they're trying to keep the stability, if you will, or lack thereof, but the homeostasis of the family, so their behavior of being angry or judgmental or frustrated, then the person with addiction will use at them. And so they keep that whole cycle going. And
yep.
It's got to not just be one person getting treated. The whole family needs help and support.
Yes, that's been my experience, is they'll inadvertently, unintentionally, sometimes pull the person who's trying to recover back into a family system and pattern that's very stressful and hurtful for all family members, unless the whole family's been treated. Yes, definitely.
And in thinking about your credentials, being a licensed clinical social worker, my experience with that has been that, unlike some of the other avenues to come into working in addiction, the emphasis that a social work training provides in terms of the family and looking at the system, looking at the community, and being able to work in a family setting, I think brings a real skill set to this process.
Yeah, I think the person and environment approach definitely does, because the family is the environmental system in which that person's going to return after treatment. And, you know, what's impacting, what are they having to look at, what's impacting that family system and the stresses that are hurting the whole family is also an important piece on how to help the person struggling with addiction. So each member of the family has their own individual stressors, and then you put that together in the group, and if they aren't treated, the tendency is to fall back in old dysfunctional coping patterns that may have led to the problem of addiction in the first place. And without treatment, we tend to automatically fall into those old patterns. You know, that just like addicts not using because they have a poor moral fiber character, neither are the family members acting out for that reason either. They're often doing things but acting out of old coping mechanisms that need to be, they need to learn new ones and be taught new ones so that they have a sense of peace and relief.
So they're figuring things out.
Exactly.
But maybe there are better ways, easier ways, less painful ways to cope with the stress of having a family member who's ill, whether that's with addiction, whether that's with a mental illness, whether that's with a chronic physical illness. Mm-hmm. We do the best we can, and I think that's my experience of working with you is accepting that the person's doing the best they can, the family's doing the best they can, but we have to help them learn ways in which they can do things that are less painful and healthier.
Yes, and each encouraging each member and teaching each member of that family how to take care of their own issues and what that looks like and what that means to be a recovering person in that within that family, so that no one has to worry about the other family members taking care of themselves. One doesn't have to worry about is my recovering addict or alcoholic family member getting help. They can receive education about what it means to get recovery and understand that it is an inside job. Each person that chooses recovery has to do their own work, as does each family member. And with support and education, particularly support from other families and other people in recovery from addiction who've been through this process, they can learn this and learn from these other families' experiences.
So in your practice, if a person calls you and sees you, mm-hmm. and they have the disease of addiction, mm-hmm. Is their family brought into the treatment? How would you handle that? Or if it was a family member calling, mm-hmm. because they had a loved one?
Generally what I do is initially set up an appointment with whoever makes the phone call and do an assessment of the situation based on whoever's comes into my office, whether it's a person struggling with the addiction, someone in early recovery, somebody just thinking they may or may not have a problem with addiction, or a family member who's concerned about a loved one. And I usually might meet for a few sessions, depending upon, you know, each individual situation. Some are more complex than others, may require more than one meeting, and then assess which direction to go. If it's a concern for a family member, then generally we frequently will, soon after the initial meeting, invite that family member in. But oftentimes I do invite family members to get their perspective, because it's important, depending upon where the person in recovery is in their recovery. Unfortunately, addiction is one of the diseases that one of the hallmarks is it tells people that they don't have it, and that denial is a big factor. So if someone's early in an addiction or early in recovery, they often aren't able to see their behavior clearly, and the family feedback can be very important from that aspect. So, I try to assess where they are and what are they asking me for. Because not everyone that comes in questioning whether or not they have an addiction or is my family loved one an alcoholic really wants to do anything about it. They just want to check it out. They may be at an early stage of contemplating change and not ready to move forward. So I have to really assess that.
So you assess it and then you help them with what they're asking for. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming you also educate them and perhaps encourage them to look at the problem in a more in-depth way, but it's okay if that's not where they're are or what they're really asking to do.
Yes, definitely. And one of the reasons I get so excited about the new scientific information is because we have concrete science now to say, hey, look, we've got these studies, we have this evidence. It's not just me as a therapist saying this is what addiction is. So I do try to utilize that.
Very good. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about Vanessa Hebert and her practice. Please get a pen and paper ready. After the break, we'll give you some contact information. I'm Dr. Susan Blank. Thanks for listening.
The disease of addiction is a life-altering challenge, not just for the person suffering its effects, but also for the family and friends who support and love the one caught in its grasp. What should be the course of treatment? Who is the best person to render treatment, and what is the best place to go for the care that is needed? We know that you want answers to these and many more questions. Call 770-696-9862 and speak to a representative of the Atlanta Healing Center. They can tailor a program specifically designed to address the needs of the person suffering with an addiction, or give you guidance as to where that help may be found. Information is the key. And the trained staff at AHC is here to assist. If you wish, you can also get more information on the website located at www.atlantahealingcenter.com.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on americaswebradio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on americaswebradio.com anytime you like.
This is Tracy Pearson with Prissy Tomboy. Listen to the Prissy Tomboy radio show every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time as I interview special guests that will inspire adventure and fitness for females.
This is Dr. Susan Blank, Medical Director for the Atlanta Healing Center. Our team is able to offer a multitude of treatment options such as quantitative EEG, also known as brain mapping, hormonal and nutritional assessments, neuropsychological testing, and cognitive therapy, along with traditional 12-step facilitation. And we can even offer you, if appropriate, a gentle medically managed detox. Please contact us at 770-696-9862.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back. This is Detailing Addiction. Today in studio I have Vanessa Hebert, LCSW, who has a private practice here in Atlanta. I'd like to give you some contact information if you'd like to learn more about her practice. You can go to www.vanessa, V-A-N-E-S-S-A. Her last name, which you need to write down, Hebert is how it's pronounced, but it's spelled H-E-B-E-R-T. So that's Vanessa, H-E-B-E-R-T.com. Or you can call her at 404-291-7500. That's 404. I'm sorry, I gave the wrong number. Please give the right number.
I'm sorry, it's 404-219-7500.
Thank you. I can't read. We've established this already frequently on this show. Sometimes I can't even remember my own name. But back to our story, A Day in the Life with Vanessa Hebert, talking about her practice. One of the things that I know you work with parents of young adults in particular, who the young adult may be struggling with addiction, disordered eating, other kinds of problems, and they're not quite ready yet to come into treatment, but the family members are really looking for some help. What are some of the things you might want to talk with them about?
Well, when I get family members of young adults, I work very hard to try to educate them about the process of the disease of addiction and also encourage them to get their own help. Because, unfortunately, as painful as watching your young adult child struggle, they are an adult, and we can't force them to receive help. And that's probably one of the hallmarks of the frustration and pain related to working with young adults and their families. The best thing, in my experience, that families can do is focus on their own recovery. And what I mean by this is seeking out support groups or 12-step groups such as Al-Anon or Families Anonymous, to hear from other family members who have experienced and walked through the feelings and struggles that you may be going through at this time. There's an interesting phenomena that seems to occur when family members are able to put the focus on themselves and focus on the things that they are able to control, such as their own reactions and their own behaviors. It frees up this, makes space for the young adult to focus on what part is theirs and are they meeting their own goals? Are they living the life the way they live? And it may be the dynamic that allows the, that takes away the pressure when the parent defocuses off of the child. It gives, and I say child meaning young adult, it gives that young adult the space to stop blaming mom and dad, stop being in a power struggle with mom and dad, because mom and dad aren't arguing anymore. They've stepped back. They're taking care of themselves. They're learning about this process of recovery. They're learning about what addiction means and the ins and outs. And then the young adult just has more space to take more responsibility for their choices when they don't feel the pressure of the parents.
So that power struggle,
yes,
very common, particularly when someone is active in their addiction. They're looking to others to help pick up the pieces, make things work, take care of the consequences. And often, because parents are parents, and that's how we've interacted with our children their whole life, that's been our role to help them, teach them, guide them, control them to some degree, those patterns continue. So breaking up that power struggle where the parent says, do this, and the child says, no, I won't, when that becomes a young adult, where we start to really see the behaviors unravel.
Yes, and the conflicts seem to get the consequences get bigger. You know, it's like we have a struggle between the personality of the young adult. They're legally a young adult. However, their behavior and their outlook oftentimes is less mature than that because of their personality developing while they may be intoxicated. So you have a legal aged person standing before you, but they're processing their cognitive processes and their expectations of being taken care of, even though they're not meeting their responsibilities, may still be of an adolescent. And that often, as you know, as the child gets older and the parents get more frustrated, the parents may begin to finally set some limits that they've wanted to now that they're getting burnt out, and the expectation of the child being cared for at 20 or 21 is now the parent has outgrown that and they're able to set some boundaries, and then we begin to have conflicts of the young adult saying, no, I'm an adult, I don't have to listen to you. They're storming out the door and using drugs because they can. They're an adult, they can make their own choices. So it perpetuates a really dangerous pattern dealing with this particular type of client in the young adult age range.
I know that for all of us, whether we have children who have the disease of addiction or not, we have to make that shift from parent-child relationship, as David Donaldson often talks to our families about, into an adult-adult relationship. We all have to make that shift. Sometimes it's even more difficult if the young person has a disease of addiction, has a mental illness, has a developmental problem. It seems that it's a harder shift for the parent in that situation to begin to relate to their child as an adult.
Yes.
We're two adults, each of us responsible for our own health, welfare, self-support, all of those things. It seems more difficult when there is an illness or a difficulty that the child, young adult, is suffering.
Yeah, I agree with you, and that's been my experience also. It seems that the fear factor of letting go as parents is so much greater, and I think that's the reason that the additional support for the families is so important. It's terrifying as a parent of a child to let go as they grow, because even though they're adults, it doesn't mean they're going to make good decisions, and we know that. And it's just terrifying to watch them walk out into the world. But when we know in our hearts, you know, with parent intuition, that they're not functioning at their best, it's even scarier.
Right.
Yeah, so I definitely agree that parents sometimes, you know, may benefit from even looking into their own therapy work for themselves to find out what is it inside of them that's causing them such great fear, and they may be struggling with some unnecessary guilt that they could work on letting go of that, you know, is from ancient history that may not be even attached to today. And that would help them be able to set the boundaries that would in turn help their young adult child who needs recovery, or, you know, even if they're just moving to college, you know, and not in active addiction, that they have to be able to fall down and scrape their knee to learn, same as we did, as, you know, adults in this world. But it's just really challenging.
It's very hard.
It
I remember when hard. my oldest son was learning to drive, and we lived in Baltimore, and I'm just terrified to give this kid the keys to the car and say, go forth and drive by yourself. It was bad enough being in the car. But it was really interesting what happened as he was able to do that. Suddenly, now, my life got a lot easier once I got over my fear.
Yes.
Once I was able to say, okay, it's going to happen. Here are the keys. Then suddenly I didn't have to, you know, take him to music lessons. I didn't have to pick him up from basketball practice or tennis practice. He was able to do those things. My life got easier.
Yeah, that's a good analogy.
So,
really.
And it's wonderful now that my children are adults. to have that adult relationship. And it's very different, mm-hmm. but it's so much fun if you can let go.
Yes, yes. It's just that process of letting go.
It's so hard.
Difficult, most definitely. That's a really good example, using the for driving example, how much freedom it gives us. And being able to process through each stage of development how much freedom we get as our children are getting that freedom. They need that freedom to grow just as much as we need it to continue on in our journeys.
Yeah. It's very nice when they learn to walk.
Yes, exactly. We don't have that backache from lugging
exactly,
them around on the hip.
Right, exactly. Not the same level.
Right.
And sometimes I think we forget that the whole goal of being a parent is to have your child grow up, be independent, be happy, be healthy.
Yeah, yeah.
And we have to let them fall, and we have to let them have consequences, mm-hmm. and we have to let them stumble and, like you said, scrape mm-hmm. your knee, because mm-hmm. that's what the work is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think when it comes to when we are speaking specifically about addiction, I feel a need to say that I do consider what is going on in the family. And if a child is using some really dangerous drugs and in such a way that their life's in danger, I wouldn't be advocating for letting them scrape their knee.
Right.
You know, I would have a whole different take on it from that perspective. So I just want to clarify that, you know, we do, I think both Susan and I do consider what's going on with that child. There's ways to allow them to face the consequences and scrape their knees and keep them safe in some cases. And it's just important to assess where they are, you know, how much rope to allow them to have. And I just wanted to mention that piece.
I think that's,
you know, especially
very
today, because there's some scary things happening in our world as it relates to addiction and young adults. And you know, sometimes we know that there's some necessary steps we have to take, too, as parents. And sometimes a parent, because of the high emotionally charged subject of this being your child and the fear for their future and their current functioning in life, you may need some professional help to make those determinations. And you know, I work with families who have a variety of, as I've said, some are in recovery themselves, some aren't, have children in treatment, some are adults, and I watch this through each stage, mm-hmm. is that it's a constant decision-making process of how much to step in and how much to step back, you know, and to have support through that process would be very, very important for family members.
Very, very good, and thank you so much for reminding us of that, because that is true. In a normal kind of kids going off to college or kids going off to work, that letting go is hard, mm-hmm. when we have the disease of addiction, when things are now not just uncomfortable but potentially life-threatening or dangerous. We need to advise the family and help them know what next steps mm-hmm. that they actually can do, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. part of the challenge in all this is, as you've said, these young people are now adults, mm-hmm. and they mm-hmm. are able to make decisions, mm-hmm. and they can exclude the family in those decisions, and that's really scary for a lot of people.
Super tricky and scary, definitely. Yeah, it's a hard piece, very hard piece.
So I think that it's very helpful for people to know that they don't have to have their loved one ready to go to treatment.
Exactly.
They can call you, get some support, get some help. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about why Vanessa calls her practice the Phoenix.
Perhaps you are struggling to cope with the disease of addiction. If not, you probably know a family member or friend that needs help in battling the cravings and the personal and professional damage done by the effects of drugs or alcohol. Get a pen and paper and be ready to write down the following. These are the issues that the trained staff at the Atlanta Healing Center address and treat every day. Their doctors and counselors with over 40 years of practice in the field of addiction can treat the suffering individual in a thoughtful, compassionate, and experienced manner and guide him or her along the path to recovery. So call 770-696-9862 and speak to a knowledgeable staff member about how you or your loved one can be helped to enjoy a better and healthier life. More information is also available on the website at www.atlantahealingcenter.com.
Hi, this is Tracy Pearson with Prissy Tomboy. The Prissy Tomboy radio show empowers females with confidence and belief in self through active, healthy lifestyles. Listen every Tuesday at 5 p.m. on America's Web Radio.
This is Michael Gannot with the Middle East Research Center Limited, bringing you insight to Israel, the truth about the greatness of the Jewish state and its struggle for sovereignty and security, every Sunday at 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
The disease of addiction is a life-altering challenge, not just for the person suffering its effects, but also for the family and friends who support and love the one caught in its grasp. What should be the course of treatment? Who is the best person to render treatment? And what is the best place to go for the care that is needed? We know that you want answers to these and many more questions. Call 770-696-9862 and speak to a representative of the Atlanta Healing Center. They can tailor a program specifically designed to address the needs of the person suffering with an addiction or give you guidance as to where that help may be found. Information is the key. And the trained staff at AHC is here to assist. If you wish, you can also get more information on the website located at www.atlantahealingcenter.com.
This is americaswebradio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back. This is Dr. Susan Blank on Detailing Addiction. We have in studio today Vanessa Hebert. If you'd like to learn more about her program, you can go to the web and look at Vanessa Hebert, spelled H-E-B-E-R-T.com, or you can call her at 404-219-7500. Did I get that right?
You did. That
good.
Was perfect. Thank you so much.
One of the things that I noticed about your practice is the name. You've called it the Phoenix.
Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about how you came up with that name?
Well, you know, the Phoenix represents the rising of from the ashes. And so that, you know, with recovery, that concept stuck with me. It resonated with me. But truly, one way it began is I have a picture that my mother had on her wall that is a phoenix rising from the ashes that says transcend all abuse. And that picture has a lot of sentimental value to me. My mother worked in this field as a counselor in the school systems in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And she had a strong passion for the same reason I do, because it was such a personal experience for all of us in our family. We not only had a passion to help other people, but a passion because of our own experience. So, you know, we know the pain of the addiction and then the beauty of recovery. So that the Phoenix just to me represents the work that we can do in recovery and in therapy. Having, you know, been down in a place in life that is really painful and can be just cause great despair and seem very hopeless. It's amazing that with proper treatment and help, how one's life can be turned around. And so the Phoenix just resonated with me in that way, because to me that's what the Phoenix represents, you know, arising from the ashes with a new life. And recovery really is that. It's quite remarkable and amazing to watch some of the stories and see some of the changes that I'm honored to be a part of, because people allow me to walk with them in their journey of recovery through my work as a therapist. And it's just remarkable. I mean, you wouldn't believe some of the stories and the turnarounds that I get to see. People that you would just think that their lives were literally over are transformed and are able to recreate very productive lives and rejoin with their families and be very productive, you know, loving members of our society and community. So it just is, it's really important to me that people know that. So that's why I chose the Phoenix.
I really like that symbol, and I like the way that you explain that, because I don't know about you, but our phone at Atlanta Healing Center doesn't ring because somebody says, oh, my life is going so well, mm-hmm. and I am so happy. Mm-hmm. I think I'll call up and make an appointment to go to rehab.
Right.
That's really not mm-hmm. where people are coming from. Mm-hmm. They're coming usually from a place of a lot of pain mm-hmm. and difficulty, lots of things have not been going well, and their life sometimes looks like it's crumbling right around them. Mm-hmm. So that whole vision of, and out of this pain and turmoil comes a new person, mm-hmm. that's beautiful and healthy and strong and happy. So yes. I love that symbol.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. I do too. It means a lot to me also. It's definitely, like I said, it's just remarkable how, because people do call my practice in despair and pain, and it's always a struggle to welcome them to the practice, you know, when I know that they're calling out of desperation. So, yeah. At least I can offer them that hope.
Exactly. Yeah, I always say, so lovely to meet you. Sorry
under these circumstances.
Circumstances.
My same words.
Because it is a difficult thing to do, but mm-hmm. I have to really congratulate people on their courage.
Oh, most definitely.
And the strength that they show in reaching mm-hmm. out and asking for help.
Yes, I think it's the hardest phone call that someone ever has to make, oftentimes.
I would really agree with that. Mm-hmm. And I know that you get some very complicated situations sometimes and some very difficult cases with mm-hmm. people that may have more than one diagnosis, may suffer from not only the disease of addiction but other psychological, physical kinds of problems. Mm-hmm. And you have some tools that mm-hmm. you have available to you because of your training and your certifications. Tell me a little bit about some of the options that you have to help people with.
Well, one of the, you know, in our in my practice, I often encounter a lot of people who oftentimes because of long-term addiction have developed some significant anxiety or disorders or depression disorders. Sometimes that predates the addiction. You know, that's what they were struggling with, and they were self-medicating with the drugs or alcohol. Sometimes when people have been using for many years through adolescence and young adulthood, they've had some personality structures that have developed while they were intoxicated, which could greatly lead into significant distortions in reality. So when someone gets sober after they've struggled in basically a fog, you know, having the drugs mm-hmm. and alcohol as a buffer to reality, they're really left there. They can feel very stripped raw, as if they're walking around in this world with no skin, you know, because it's such a difficult experience initially in early recovery. So one of the things that I was very excited to learn about in my practice is a therapy called dialectical behavioral therapy. DBT is the shorthand version, and it composes two different types of treatment, individual therapy and skills training. And I utilize a skills training group to help a lot of my clients who are getting sober and need new skills. DBT comprises four different modules. There's mindfulness, which is the core of DBT, because learning how to be in the present moment, aware of ourselves in the present moment, is one of the important aspects of coming back to reality and getting sober. You have to be able to tolerate how you feel just sitting in a chair. So that's a beginning, and it coincides well with the philosophy of 12-step programs one day at a time, 24 hours a day philosophy. And I guess that's another reason I'm partial to the 12 steps as a form of recovery, because it is the oldest known successful program that we have. It has a lot of flaws, and people are often critical of it. So I like to utilize DBT with encouraging people to participate in 12 steps because they complement each other very well. The other component of DBT is called distress. Another module is called distress tolerance, and it teaches coping mechanisms so that you can tolerate a crisis or distress, some significant negative emotions, without causing any more damage, without making it worse in the moment with a negative reaction. So those skills are very important. And the other another module is interpersonal effectiveness, which helps us to communicate effectively, with the goal being effectively. Oftentimes, folks that have personality struggles tend to get stuck in black and white thinking and looking for life to be fair and thinking that, you know, it's either fair or unfair, and getting very black and white in that dynamic. And so helping them to see that what's the goal of your communication here? You know, what is the outcome you want to achieve? So we teach skills around that. And at the moment, my mind just went blank on what the fourth module is. Mindfulness, distress tolerance, interpersonal effectiveness. And I just went blank on the fourth one. Now I have to think about that. Old age is catching up with me.
that will come to us. But the whole way in which you can do that is through both group and individual, correct?
Definitely, yeah. The individual therapy helps a person utilize their skills. When you go into a DBT trained therapist can help someone know which situations to utilize their skills in. And DBT also has, they just recently came out with their second edition, and they have a whole section of skills for addictive behavior. And they define addictive behavior as any behavior that you can compulsively can't stop that causes you consequences. So that could be applied for many of us.
So not just around addiction, but also around other kinds of behaviors.
Unwanted behaviors, yes. Mm-hmm. That can really go for anything, you know. And that's what has been helpful in the DBT skills group. When we have folks who haven't really self-identified as addicts but are struggling with some compulsive behaviors that are causing them negative consequences, they can really latch on to the idea of needing to do something differently without feeling threatened by needing to decide whether they have addiction or not. You know, so we kind of, I guess you can sneak in the back door in that respect, introducing that concept without the defensiveness that some people tend to go to when you start talking about addiction.
And so when you talk about some of the skill training, this isn't just gaining insight into why you might have a difficulty understanding your history and so this and such has happened to you, and that's why you react in an angry way or a fearful way. It goes beyond that.
It very much does. The insight that you're describing, that work would be more in the individual therapy work. Mm-hmm. And then the skills training is actually learning and practicing skills, so concretely practicing them and going home. And we assign homework and teach a new skill in each group and send our clients home to do it and then come back and talk about what did you do. And we break it down exactly. Why did it not work? Which skill did you try? How do you think you might have been able to do that differently? And really assist them in practicing. And we'll do role-playing in the group to help assist with that skill learning, because it really takes a lot of practice for people to be able to implement the skills in real life, in real time, in their own lives and personal situations. And I was able to remember the last skill is emotion regulation. I'm surprised I forgot that one. It's one of the most important.
Exactly.
Yeah, because this is exactly the hallmark of the struggle that a early recovering addict may have is the dysregulation of their emotions. So the emotion regulation helps to teach. That is an educational component about what emotions are. A lot of people that have addiction aren't even aware when they're having certain feelings what they are. They know that something's not right inside of them, but they can't put a word to it.
Right.
So the emotion regulation component helps teach what different emotions are, what they may what situations you may have, what emotion, and then how to deal with that if they're dysregulated.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about how the skill learned in DBT can be helpful to ground people and help them to cope. I'm Dr. Susan Blank. Thanks for listening.
The disease of addiction is a life-altering challenge, not just for the person suffering its effects, but also for the family and friends who support and love the one caught in its grasp. What should be the course of treatment? Who is the best person to render treatment? And what is the best place to go for the care that is needed? We know that you want answers to these and many more questions. Call 770-696-9862 and speak to a representative of the Atlanta Healing Center. They can tailor a program specifically designed to address the needs of the person suffering with an addiction or give you guidance as to where that help may be found. Information is the key. And the trained staff at AHC is here to assist. If you wish, you can also get more information on the website located at www.atlantahealingcenter.com.
Hello, I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak. Have you ever wondered what doctors talk about amongst themselves? If you do, join us on the Doctor's Lounge and hear the doctor's conversations amongst themselves. Join me and my co-host, Dr. Hal Schertz, every Thursday morning, 8 to 9 a.m.
This is Dr. Susan Blank, Medical Director for the Atlanta Healing Center. Our team is able to offer a multitude of treatment options, such as quantitative EEG, also known as brain mapping, hormonal and nutritional assessments, neuropsychological testing, and cognitive therapy, along with traditional 12-step facilitation. And we can even offer you, if appropriate, a gentle medically managed detox. Please contact us at 770-696-9862.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back. This is Dr. Susan Blank, detailing addiction on America's Web Radio. Today we have Vanessa Hebert, and we're talking about her practice and particularly about DBT, which I unfortunately am not trained in, but have experienced working with patients who have been through that and how helpful it is. I was hoping that maybe you might give an example of a situation in which a patient might be struggling and how a DBT scale might be helpful to them, because I think that's a little would be really helpful for our listeners.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Well, I think when in the module interpersonal effectiveness, how to communicate has been one of the challenges that almost everyone, no matter what their age, seems to struggle with. How to communicate effectively being the key. Because often, as I mentioned earlier, oftentimes people get stuck in the concept of right and wrong and forget that their goal is to actually communicate a certain message. So one thing that we see frequently with our patients who are recovering, and this is generally it can be of any age, not even just young adults, is the need to communicate that they're no longer interested in using drugs. And they still, you know, oftentimes because of the way young adults in our society socialize, they'll still come in contact with a lot of drug-using friends. So drug refusal skills and how to say that. So in interpersonal effectiveness, that module, they actually have acronyms that we use to help teach communication, and we break it down. One is called Dear Man, and we break that down, and each letter stands for a different word to teach them how to state, you know, D, for example, is describe. You describe the circumstances, you know, and then you explain under E why you don't want to participate in this any longer, and then A is assert, and R is repeat, and we help our clients to articulate using these guidelines, and it teaches them also how to speak, not only maintaining their boundary, but in letting the other people know why it's a good thing for the relationship that person no longer uses drugs. And, you know, those things don't occur when we're in early recovery and just trying to stay sober, just trying to do the next right thing, get to the next place for support, meet up with a sponsor, get to see their therapist, get to see their doctor. You know, it's very difficult to also learn that on their own, and it's not really taught anywhere. Another tool that we use is called Broken Record, and that's just simply to teach them how to repeat the answer no and why they're saying no. And when they continue to get pushed to participate, how to repeat that, and just like a broken record. Of course, I'm dating myself now because we don't even use records anymore.
My grandkids don't even know what a
record is.
Type is.
Yeah, exactly. So there's that. We have to teach them what a record is, I guess, too. Those are just really simplistic examples. But how to maintain their boundaries around saying no and engaging in the new behavior in which they're trying to engage. So
that is so important, mm-hmm. and so difficult, mm-hmm. particularly for young adults.
Yes, I think so.
They don't know how to date, mm-hmm. because people want to go to the bar, mm-hmm. or go to the tailgate at mm-hmm. the football game, or go hang out at a club mm-hmm. somewhere. And it's really hard for them to be able to first even understand that they can say no, and how to do it. And
yes.
The practice is So important.
Very important. So that when they're faced with it in the heat of the moment, that they can implement it because they've done it so many times before. Because otherwise, it's very easy to just want to go along. There's so much shame connected to, you know, maybe being behind your the class that you were with in college, you know, because you had to go to treatment or something along those lines. So it's very, because of the high emotionality involved in those circumstances, it's important that they have those skills down pat, concrete, with a lot of practice.
And that they can understand how to recognize the dangerous situation and be prepared mm-hmm, for it. Because mm-hmm. I think that's one of the difficulties when people are in active treatment for addiction. They're learning that I can't use and this is why I can't use. But they don't often have that next step, mm-hmm. which is, okay, and when you go home and you're invited to a party,
yeah.
how
then
do
what?
You handle that?
Exactly.
So thinking about that, having those skills, having the acronym that they can
right.
repeat.
And we would have actually had, you know, we've actually practiced that. We get real life examples from our clients that participate in the groups, and we rehearse them
mm-hmm.
literally over and over and rehearse them within the group so that they have a script basically in their head. And that's something I often do with clients anyway when they struggle with, you know, difficult relationships, or they tend to have high emotionality and get emotionally charged quickly in their relationships, is write out a script, you know, for communication. So that seems to be a tool that is really helpful. Yeah, definitely. And it goes along, like I'd mentioned earlier, DBT skills to me are just a great complement to some of the work that people do in 12-step recovery, because some of the steps and some of the skills coincide, you know, the end result of them and the work they do are similar. Yeah. And, you know, I want to mention, too, about what you said about not having this training. I've had the same experience in my practice when I have clients that have come to the Atlanta Healing Center for neurofeedback, because
mm-hmm.
I'm not as familiar with that as y'all are over there, and I've been amazed at the difference in the clients when they get some neurofeedback work done. And I can't mm-hmm. even explain, I can't even articulate that very well because I don't know what it is, but I know it has amazing results. People come back and they're thinking so much clearly and able to articulate in ways that they couldn't initially.
Yeah. Well, that was one of my my goals in getting trained in functional medicine
mm-hmm.
was seeing that so many of my patients are motivated, they're trying, and yet they're not always successful
mm-hmm.
in staying sober. And as Dr. Talbot used to tell mm-hmm. us all the time, mm-hmm. too many people are still dying.
Yes.
So learning to have some additional skills
mm-hmm.
like the neurofeedback, which can accelerate some of the healing of the brain
okay.
and help to treat some of the symptoms like anxiety or sleep disorder or concentration
mm-hmm.
problems, actually help the brain become more flexible,
oh.
Able to move from one feeling state
mm-hmm.
to another.
Mm-hmm.
We all need to sleep. We all need to relax. We all need to focus.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we need to run and hide or stay and fight.
Yeah.
Most of our patients live in run and hide or stay and fight,
mm-hmm.
and their idling of their brain is too fast, too quick,
mm-hmm.
so they can't sleep and they feel anxious.
Right.
So this helps to calm that down
mm-hmm.
and also helps with the fluidity so that they can make some choices. Now I need to study. Now I need to relax. Now I need to go to sleep.
Yeah.
And those kinds of things, I think, are one of the gifts that neurofeedback can help our patients with, because sure, I could give them some Ambien to sleep or some Xanax
mm-hmm.
so they wouldn't be anxious, or I could give them some Adderall for their ADD,
mm-hmm.
But not for my patients who
right.
have the disease of addiction.
Mm-hmm.
So, but we still have to help them with those symptoms
mm-hmm.
and we have to do it in a way that doesn't compromise their recovery from addiction.
From addiction. And that's such an important tool. And it's really that I'm just thinking how much that complements the concept of DBT and the black and white thinking, the concreteness, you know, helping clients to move out of that concrete black and white thinking is important as part of recovery. So that neurofeedback and the DBT philosophies really complement.
They very much do. Mm-hmm. And patients that have those skills that I can remind them of, and
mm-hmm.
what did you learn in DBT? And so in this situation, how might you have handled that differently when you got really mad at your boyfriend, or you yelled at your boss and
mm-hmm.
then you got fired? How might you have handled that better?
Yes.
very helpful for them to learn those skills because, you know, most of us learn those things in our teen years by trial and error and some bumps and bruises. If you're using drugs or alcohol or other addictive behaviors during that period of time, you don't learn those skills. And you wake up, you know, 5 or 6 years later, everybody else knows how to manage that, knows how to, I'd really like to say that to my boss, but I need my job. I'm not going to do that. They don't know how to manage that. They know how to yell at their boss. And say what they're, what they'd like to say.
And act out that frustration.
So the DBT skills is an opportunity for them to really learn some coping mechanisms that they might have missed or only partly learned or not have used for a long time. And that's that is incredibly important.
Yes, I agree. That's been it's been really helpful to my clients, most definitely. It's interesting as we're talking, it makes me think about the comprehensive nature of treating addiction and how important it is that, because I know for my clients, they come with different it's just not cookie cutter. Everybody has a little bit of different need and how important it is to seek the help that's out there for and be treated for your symptoms, not compare yourself to, say, someone else that's sitting in a 12-step meeting. And just talking about the neurofeedback and all the tools out there, how comprehensive we have treatment we have available, you know, that if people will seek it.
And to put together a team.
Yes.
And they may not always be in the same building
Most
or the
definitely.
Same part of the city, but a team that can communicate, can share ideas, can highlight when there's a problem brewing, and to adjust the treatment plan so that the patient and their family have the best opportunity for success.
Yes, definitely. And that continuity of care. I know that's another piece that back in, you know, the early 80s that we didn't have and we're still struggling with on some level, but I think we're getting there. And I know in the cases that we've been able to work on together, how important that is, the continuity of care from, say, a residential treatment facility to an outpatient environment, that the communication between the residential treating physician get to the outpatient treating physician, the treating physician on outpatient communicate with the therapist so that they're not misleading or giving confusing signals to the client, because this is this difficult, you know, issue to be having to recover from. And there's ways to handle that if clients will access it.
Absolutely, and I have appreciated being able to work with you.
Me too.
Again, Vanessa Hebert at 404-219-7500. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week on Detailing Addiction.
This is America's Webradio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.